This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm bringing you a slightly different interview. The thing that's typical is that I'm interviewing a national journalist about their area of expertise. I interview Maureen Groppi. She's the Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. What's different is that this interview is largely about my constitutional law students' questions. She was a guest speaker in my constitutional law class, and this episode grew out of questions that my students had for a journalist who's covering the court, and therefore a journalist who's covering the way that constitutional law is changing seemingly day by day. So I hope you enjoy this conversation, and next week we will come back and bring you more about the 2024 election and likely a short wrap-up of the debate. Wishing everybody a great week. Maureen, thank you again so much for being here. I'm excited to have this conversation and excited to ask you all these great questions that my constitutional law students came up with.
They're great questions, and I hope I can do them justice.
Well, absolutely. I think the first one, and I got this one a bunch, was what made you want to cover this beat, assuming that it was a decision that you made, and what has surprised you most about it?
So most of my career in Washington, I covered Washington for local newspapers from a local angle. I'm from Indiana. I primarily wrote for the Indianapolis Star. And in that role, I would occasionally cover Supreme Court case from Indiana, and I found that fascinating. I enjoyed it. And then when I joined USA Today, I was first covering Congress for them, and then most recently the White House. And then in January, our Supreme Court reporter left. There was a lot going on at the court. They needed someone to step in right away, and they asked me if I would do it at least on a temporary basis. And I said, yeah, and I thought I might want to do it permanently. And so I made that switch, and I like it. I like hearing and reading the arguments from both sides. I like the range of the issues, from the quirky ones about, there was one about a woman who would honk her horn when passing a group of people who she believed with protesters, and she would honk her horn, and she got a ticket for that. And she fought that as a First Amendment right. And the court did not end up taking her case, but you get quirky ones like that that are fun to write about. And then, of course, you have the hugely consequential decisions, and we had many of those this past term. And then I like also having done Congress and the White House, and now I get to cover the Supreme Court. So I like having been able to say that I've covered all three branches of government. Oh, you asked what has surprised me. I guess when I was covering this just on an occasional basis, I didn't realize that there's an unofficial transcript of the oral arguments that the full-time Supreme Court reporters get, not immediately after, a little bit after, takes a while to get it after the oral argument. And that's extremely helpful. Although now that the oral arguments are live streamed, you can, if you're not in the room, you can record it yourself. But that was why didn't I know? I wish I had known about that in those past cases when I had to cover them, and you're sitting there trying to figure out who said that and what exactly did they say? Did I get this quote right? So that's maybe not the kind of surprise your students are thinking of, but that was a nice surprise for me.
It is an exceedingly relatable surprise in the sense that I've had a few jobs, and every one of them, there's been some moment where I've thought, why didn't I know that? Why didn't anybody tell me that? Or it would have been really useful to know that beforehand. You brought up oral arguments, and I got a couple of questions about this, which is, how much do you think oral arguments make a difference to Supreme Court cases? Does it matter if it's a big case, a little case, if they know a little bit about it, if it's highly controversial? How much does an oral argument move the needle?
Of course, that's hard for me to say because you don't know, can't get inside the justice heads before or after the arguments. And a lot of times it seems like, okay, well, these justices are asking specific questions to be friendly to this side or the other side, or just to challenge a side or the other side. So it seems like you know, they're not maybe not as open to hearing the other side. But there have been times when, you know, I think you can say that things came up in oral argument that mattered. And a good example of that from this last term is the emergency abortion case from Idaho.
Yes.
Trying to decide, yeah, EMTALA, does the federal law that requires emergency rooms to provide stabilizing care, does that mean that even in states that have strict abortion bans, that doctors in those hospitals have to give a woman an option of an abortion if needed to prevent serious injury to her, the loss of reproductive organs, or serious infections, or other serious health risks. And in oral argument, Justice Barrett in particular, they were trying to pin down, okay, well, where exactly is the conflict between the state ban and the federal law? What is or is not allowed under one or the other? And Justice Barrett, when one of the liberal justices was trying to pepper the attorney from Idaho about, okay, well, what's covered and not covered, and Justice Barrett jumped in and said she was shocked because she thought that the lawyer for Idaho was saying something different from what the state had previously said about, you know, what was covered and what was not covered. And a law professor I talked to in writing the end of the term stories, he said he thought that was the moment that Idaho lost the case. And what happened is the court ended up not deciding the case. They said, oh, you know, we took this case too early. There's a lot of things that need to be worked out, including exactly where the differences are. And they sent it back. That was one where, you know, that was a moment where if at least if this law professor's right, you know, that could have been the critical moment for that case.
I agree. It's so interesting because I was thinking about that case and I was thinking about Justice Barrett. And I wonder how much is it that sometimes oral arguments matter and it depends on the topic, it depends on the advocates, but also it increasingly seems to me that it depends on Justice Barrett. And I remember writing about her and writing about this term and writing about that moment because it did seem like that case just suddenly disintegrated the moment that she said, hold on, hold on. And how does it seem to you that the newer justices are changing oral arguments? I mean, does it seem to you like if you just read the transcript without the names, you know, oh, that's a Justice Barrett question, that's a Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson question? Do they all have very different and identifiable styles?
They do. And interestingly, on Justice Jackson, so she's got her memoir that just came out this week. She's been doing a ton of public appearances about that. And one question she's gotten asked a few times by journalists is why she essentially talks so much. She's there are people who track these kinds of statistics for each term, and she's by far, you know, speaks the most at oral arguments. And her answer is that in part that she spent most of her time as a judge being a solo judge, not as a before she joined the Supreme Court, she was on the Circuit Court of Appeals, where she was usually on a panel of three. But before that, she spent most of her time as the only judge in her courtroom. And so she said, well, she's the one who has to ask all the questions, and she maybe hasn't quite adjusted to being part of nine yet. But she also said that these are important cases, and she's not going to shy away from asking questions.
And that certainly is the rap on her, that she didn't give it a moment, that she got in there. And some people think it's wonderful, and I think maybe some of her colleagues are irritated by that, but she just jumps in and asks a lot of questions. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about this as she does more interviews with respect to her memoir. There was one question from my students that came up more often than any other question, and that is about, how do you report in a neutral, impartial, objective — they use different words to, as I read it, mean the same thing — way when these cases have such huge, not just legal, but also political, moral, ethical consequences, and when you as a person must have your own views on some of these cases? That how do you maintain impartiality in your work?
Yeah, that's a question that I get asked as a journalist all the time, not just on the Supreme Court beat. And so, you know, it's interesting that how much people are interested in that. And one of the advantages of this beat, of covering the Supreme Court, is you get both sides laid out for you, first in the briefs and then in the oral arguments. So, you know, you don't have any excuse for not hearing both sides. You've got the material, but then, of course, you have to present it fairly. And one way that I try to do that is trying to focus on what the impact of the decision, what are the practical consequences of that? Because I'm trying to, for the audience that I write for, this general interest audience, I'm trying to explain to them what these cases mean for them. And so sometimes that's neutral, but sometimes it's not a question of, you know, liberal or conservative. It's just we don't really know what the impact of some of these decisions are. You know, when the court, one of their big decisions this year to overturn the Chevron deference and say that when the statute is ambiguous, if the law is ambiguous, the courts are no longer going to defer to the interpretation of the federal agency in putting out a rule or a regulation. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about how much difference that's going to make. And so, you know, it can be hard, you know, how much credence do you give to, for example, the environmentalists who say, okay, this means that all these environmental rules are going to be so much harder to withstand challenges. And then the other side saying, well, no, it's, you know, it's not going to be that drastic. And so that's one of the things that's hard when you don't really know what the impact of some of these decisions can be. So you end up, you know, just here's what one side said, here's what the other side says.
Well, and that helps to educate, as you said, a general audience. I got a number of questions on this too, which is how do you go about digesting these complicated legal issues and then making it easy to understand for a general audience, for people who not only don't have a legal background, but may have no background whatsoever in a particular topic. Like you just mentioned Chevron deference. I don't think that's something that members of the general public kind of walk around thinking about executive agencies and how they interpret congressional statutes and whether or not federal judges should defer to that interpretation and how that makes any difference to their lives. So what's the process, a lot of my students wanted to know, of taking a complicated legal question like this and saying to a USA Today reader who wants to know more about it, here's what you need to know.
That can be a challenge. And, you know, in that case, in the Chevron deference case, that was particularly hard in some ways. But we did have these fishermen who were the ones who had brought this challenge about a particular regulation that they thought was imposed without the authority to do so. And so we could, in doing the setup for that story, for the oral arguments, could, you know, lead with this fisherman. So you put a human face on it. And, you know, try to do that in all these cases when I'm trying to decide which of these cases I'm writing about. You know, I'm much more likely to write about a case, you know, if I can put a human face on it, or be concrete about how this impacts particular people. And then I've got an editor who is very quick to, when she's editing my story, saying too jargony, and, you know, find another word. And sometimes that's really frustrating. If, well, you know, okay, I do try to avoid using the word injunction, but I'm not sure what other word I can use for overturned. And then, you know, I was writing about something on the emergency docket recently, this fight between Oklahoma and the Biden administration over these Title X funds, which are family planning funds that are given to help for health clinics that are doing birth control and other kinds of reproductive care. And, you know, I'd always call Title X funds family planning funds. My editor said, that's too jargony. What's family planning? Be more specific. I'm like, family? All right. So I've got someone who's always trying. So now, you know, as I write these, I have to think, okay, is she going to say that that's too jargony and try to think of some other word to or a way to describe it?
even at your level, there's somebody saying, can we change it? Can we edit it? Is word choice? And it's a good reminder for all of us that when it comes to journalism at your level, there are multiple layers of people who are also looking at your stories. It's not just you. It's a group of people, not to take anything away from what you're doing, but hopefully to make people feel like they can trust the press in the sense that it's not you saying, I want to, as a personal matter, write about this. It's you thinking about an audience and a whole team of people as well, as I understand it.
Yeah. And then sometimes there's that tension between my editors trying to simplify something or make it sound more interesting. And I'm saying, well, no, that's a better way of saying it, but it's now wrong. And so some of these things, you have to have some complexity in these things. I know, you know, just to be accurate. So that's a tension on other beats that I've had, but particularly on this one, when you are dealing with these very often very technical legal questions, and the editor says, well, isn't this an easier way to say it? Well, it's easier, but it's wrong.
It's simplified, but inaccurate.
Yes.
I want to pivot for a second to the fact that you have covered all three branches of government. It does seem to me, and maybe this is just by virtue of what I do, that the Supreme Court is uniquely facing a crisis of confidence that it hasn't in recent history. And we can think about all these different reasons why that might be the case. But is that your perception as a Supreme Court reporter as well? Or is this just kind of, I think I heard Chief Justice John Roberts say recently, like, show me a time in history when people haven't criticized the Supreme Court. Is there something different about this time period? Is it partly not just that people may or may not agree with the decisions, but there are also some ethical considerations that we talk about with respect to some of the justices?
I think the Chief Justice could be right in some ways, but not in others. I mean, there's this legal historian who's got a book coming out on the history of the Supreme Court, and he says that the justices have always been criticized for making decisions based on political rather than legal grounds, and that typically that criticism has come from the left, because for most of the history, other than between the 1940s and the 1970s, when the court tacked to the left, the justices have more often been on the right of the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there are a number of recent events that have happened that have brought a lot of attention to the court, both in terms of the actions of individual justices as well as to the decisions that they're making. And then there are plenty of polls that have shown how that has affected the public's perception of the court. You know, the court had enjoyed higher favorability ratings, approval ratings from the public than the White House or Congress, and no more, or, you know, it's their ratings have gone down. And polls, some we've done, some the Associated Press have done recently, other people have done, show that there's an interest in a lot of these reforms that have been proposed. A lot of them have high backing, particularly the idea of term limiting justices. So, you know, I think that we are in a time where the court has gotten a lot of scrutiny, and for some obvious reasons. But it's also true that that criticism of the court is nothing new.
Well, and this was actually my next question, which is, after the criticism comes, you know, is there a solution? And you already touched on this, the idea that Supreme Court reform is a hot topic. And so there's the question of, you know, whether or not, as you said, there will be term limits, whether or not we can even do that without a constitutional amendment, whether or not there could be a binding ethics code. Do you see real movement on these issues as somebody who's covered the political branches as well as now the judicial branch? It seems to me that these are largely in the conversation, but I don't see a lot of concrete action.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's certainly getting a lot more attention these days, in part because President Biden came out with his proposals for reform. But I don't see them going anywhere. They are difficult to achieve, difficult to get through a divided Congress. Some of them would could require constitutional amendments, which are very hard. So I see a lot of talk about this, but I don't see a lot of prospects for any of these proposals going anywhere.
I agree. And I know that that will disappoint a lot of people because there is understandably a huge desire to reform the court. And I think for reasons that make sense and for reasons that maybe don't make sense, and that I think there's an impulse of, I don't like a decision and therefore there must be something wrong with the justices. And then on the other hand, I think you can look at the structure of the court and say, yeah, there are like rotating terms. I'm just speaking for myself, of course. There's some really good reasons that we would want to look at something like that. Again, I don't see any of it in the near future. What I do see in the near future is there will be another term. And before I ask you about the specifics of the big cases that the court has decided to take, and I know the term isn't, you know, fully fleshed out, they're still going to continue to take cases. Are there big areas where you see, oh, this is a hot topic? I mean, certainly when it comes to legal issues, you know, a lot of people talk about AI in the law, but that's different from the cases that percolate up to the Supreme Court. Do we see more Second Amendment cases, more cases about the administrative state? Will we continue to see more cases dealing with reproductive rights? Like, are there big chunks, big areas where you say, oh, that's really going to be active on the docket now?
Well, I think we're going to continue to see cases on reproductive rights because of the reverberation still from the Dobbs decision. And there were, of course, two abortion-related cases this term, which were the first ones since Dobbs, and they ended up finding reasons to not to decide the merits of either one. And so those issues, particular issues or other issues, are likely to be coming back. How soon, I don't know. We've got another EMTALA case from Texas that there's a cert petition before the court. They could be deciding in the next few weeks whether to take what to do with that one or not. So at some point, that's going to come back. Guns are going to come back because, again, of another decision that the court made that is having these reverberations on the. Since the conservative court has changed the rules about what is not allowed under gun control, there's still a lot of questions about, under those new rules, can you ban assault weapons? What particular kinds of people can or cannot be banned from having guns? Can any felon be banned from having a gun? What about someone who's a nonviolent felon? What about someone who passed a bad check years ago? So those are those issues that the court has not taken. They had a chance to take a case about assault weapons from Illinois, and they did not do it yet. So they may be waiting to see. They want the lower court to try to figure some of these issues out yet before they dive back into that one again. And then you mentioned the administrative law stuff. So conservatives know that they've got this conservative court, and they made some big gains on their agenda of trying to, quote, shrink the administrative state with Chevron and some of the other decisions that happened. But they're going to keep pushing that while they've got this court to see what else they can do to chip away at that. So we're likely to see more cases like that too, I think.
And I think something you and I've talked about offline, but also this question of freedom from discrimination versus freedom of religion and freedom of speech. That also seems like a topic that is likely to come back in different iterations. And could you highlight a little bit for us, what are the cases that you have your eyes on? The beginning of the term is about 4 weeks away now. As I mentioned, the court's going to continue to fill out the rest of its calendar. They haven't accepted all the cases that they're going to hear. But what are some big cases that we should keep our eyes on?
So there is a gun case. Now, this isn't a Second Amendment case. This is another, this is actually in the sort of the administrative law area, or did the Biden administration have the ability to regulate what are called ghost guns, these guns that you can put together from kits that they don't have, they're hard to trace. And so the Biden administration is trying to regulate them. And the Fifth Circuit said that what they're actually doing is rewriting gun laws, and only Congress can do that. So that's one of the early cases that will get a lot of attention. Another case that'll have a huge spotlight on it is this issue about state bans on transgender care for minors. The one that the court took is the Biden administration challenged Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming medical treatment, these puberty blockers, hormone therapy for people under the age of 18. Those bans are around the country, and they've been been challenged in the courts. And so the court pretty much had to take this to try to settle this issue. And that's going to be a huge case this fall. We've got a case about e-cigarettes. I don't know if you, there was just this week how e-cigarettes and vaping has gone down among young people. This case is about whether the federal government is unfairly blocking the marketing of flavored e-cigarettes, which they have this tight control on it because they're trying to prevent young people from being attracted to e-cigarettes because their flavor, they taste like cotton candy or other fun flavors. But the industry says that they've imposed this de facto ban on non-tobacco flavored products, and they don't have the authority to do that. So that's an interesting case. And then we've got a case out of Texas about whether Texas can require online age verification to access pornographic websites, and other states tried to do this too. And the argument is that, does that infringe on the free speech rights of adult users? It's one thing if you have to, if you go to a store to purchase a magazine, an adult magazine, and you show your ID to do that, and you keep your ID. But if you've got this website and you have to, you know, upload an ID, there's concerns about what happens to that information. What if that website is hacked? And then that's a big, you know, privacy issue. So that's going to be an interesting case to watch as well.
And we'll be following your reporting for all of those. I want to end by talking a little bit about your experiences with the justices. So I had a number of students ask, basically, do you interact with the justices? Do you interview them? Is most of your interaction from being at oral arguments and watching them? Like, how do you get to know them and report on them?
Most of my interaction with them is through observation, either through the oral arguments, and I have to decide if it's a case I'm not writing about, is it still worth my time to sit there and listen to it? So especially as I'm new to this beat and just, you know, learning about the individual justices. I didn't have a lot of extra time in this last term because I was
understatement
a lot of these things. So I'm hoping to be able to do that a little bit more this term. And then, you know, you try to also pay attention to what they're saying outside of the court. And that's difficult to do. They don't often publicize when they're going to be speaking somewhere. And if they do, it may not be easily accessible. It may not be online, for example. You may have to travel there, and it's hard to convince my boss as well. You got to send me to California to listen to Justice Kagan talk to the Ninth Circuit Conference. I don't know if she's going to make news, and a lot of times they don't, but you should send me anyway because she might, and we don't get that many chances to listen to them talk outside the courtroom. So usually they don't send me. And she did, when she spoke in July, she did make news in talking about how the court could possibly enforce the ethics code. And she is going to be speaking on Monday at New York University. And that one, I am going to get to go up to listen to her, and I won't get to ask her any questions, but I will get to hear her. And then, as I mentioned, Justice Jackson has a memoir out. She's been doing a lot of interviews. I've got an interview with her later this month. So that'll be the first time I'll have a one-on-one with a justice.
This was another common question, which is, in your observation of the justices, which of course includes watching them in oral arguments, as you said, tracking them when they're making out-of-court statements, and also just reading their writing to see if they seem like they're angry at each other, if it seems like they're trying to build consensus. There were a couple of questions about whether or not this court, because we all talk about how divided it is, it's a 6-3 court, it's very conservative, there's such vigorous dissent. Do they personally seem to be getting along, which I'm going to take one step further and say, I think a lot of my students were curious about, do the disagreements truly seem to stay on the page? Meaning, are they really, I look at this legal question this way, you look at this legal question in a different way, but that's okay. Or do they seem to spill over to a place where there really is personal animosity and maybe some accusation that what some of the justices are doing isn't truly judging? I know there's a lot there, but I think what my students are trying to figure out is how much of this seems to be a division between I'm a textualist or an originalist versus you're a pragmatist, to use Justice Breyer's term, and how much of this seems to be a fight that's becoming increasingly personal?
The best person to answer that question would be CNN's Joan Biskupic, who is so wired into this court and knows, you know, what can read body language and can he also know behind the scenes when there are real disputes or not. I am so far from being able to do that. What I can say is that I've heard so many, just in the few months that I've been on this beat, I'm constantly hearing the justices themselves talk about how collegial they are, how they all get along. Justice Barrett and Justice Sotomayor earlier this year, they spoke to the National Governors Association about healthy conflict, and they talked about, Barrett said the first person who called her to congratulate her as soon as she was confirmed was Sotomayor. And when she joined the court, when she showed up, as around Halloween, and Sotomayor was there with Halloween candy for Barrett's kids. And so they were really, you know, emphasizing that they get along, and also emphasizing that most of a large chunk of the cases are not these politically divided cases. They're unanimous or near unanimous. They all like to cite the statistics on that. And then Justice Kagan, as I mentioned, when she spoke at the Ninth Circuit Conference in July, she had a slightly different take. She sort of dismissed the focus on do we lunch together? Does anyone still go to the opera like Ruth Bader Ginsburg did with Scalia? And she said she can't imagine why the public would care about that, about palling around like that. She said what is important is whether they are willing to listen to each other, put themselves in the other person's shoes. And she was saying that, you know, that she thinks that they do all get along, and that the other thing that is important is whether when they write their opinions or their dissents, they don't make them too personal or too sharp. And she said one rule she has for herself to try to avoid making it too personal or too divisive is she avoids using adjectives. So she doesn't call something ridiculous. She just tries to describe why it's wrong without using, you know, words like that. But she said that Kennedy was was really the enforcer on that, that he'd look at a draft of opinion and he'd call the justice and say, well, do you really need to use that language or, you know, that phrase? And she said that he never did that himself. And so that he was a good one to be able to make those calls, and that they all miss him and miss doing that. But she was also, she had a little bit more of a nuance, but still saying, yes, you know, we do get along. We are friendly with each other, and you know, we try to make this work.
Well, last question, and two kind of related questions, which is either what's the biggest misconception about the court or about covering the court? And I'm going to let you pick which question you want to answer, because there were a bunch in both buckets.
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. I think maybe it is that people don't realize how few cases they take, that they get, you know, more than 7,000 cert petitions a year, and they hear these days around 60. And so, you know, somebody will flag for me a story or the fact that, you know, someone is appealing this to the Supreme Court. And I'll be like, don't get excited. It's not, there's a small, very small chance that they're going to hear it. So that's one sort of expectation that I have to manage even among journalists. So I guess maybe that I would, that's what I would say about the misconception about the court.
Maureen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for answering all of these questions. I hope that you'll come back soon and talk about the rest of the term.
Thank you for having me, and I would love to do that.